You're listening to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. What you're about to listen to is a live session from day 3 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023.
It's wonderful to be here.
Good morning.
I'm very excited to talk about this book, especially because David is a fellow archaeologist. So it's really nice to be here with somebody. And you know, you get a lot of questions from people from many different disciplines, philosophy, but it's nice to do something a little bit archaeologically focused. And this book, I'll hold it up because it's very beautiful. Absolutely stunning cover. This book really has been extraordinary. It was a finalist for the Orwell Prize for Political Writing. It came in at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list the week that it was released, only held off the top spot because Will Smith released his biography, I think, at the same time. It's been massively widely reviewed. It's received enormous amounts of acclaim, rightly so. And it really has been a phenomenon, I think, in many ways. I don't think there's many books focusing on sort of the archaeological record in the way that this does, and the ethnographic record that have sort of been such big hits. And I do remember seeing adverts for this book, huge adverts on the London Underground, the Tube, which I have never seen before for an archaeological book. So yes, it's fantastic to be here with you, David. And of course, this was a co-written book, and your co-author, David Graebler, very sadly passed away not long after you finished this. So I would really like to open up our discussion by talking a little bit about the motivations that you both had for writing this enormous book with such a broad scope, and you know, where you saw the focus of it and what your expectations were for perhaps how it would be received.
Well, mostly fun. Mostly we did it for fun. And initially, we thought we'd write something pretty short, maybe a little pamphlet or something, just trying to disabuse readers of some very common and pervasive fallacies about human history. And this is going back a while. This is going back to around 2010, around the time of the last big financial crash, when there was a glut of books on the topic of inequality by people from all kinds of different fields, all the obvious ones, economists, political theorists, and also historians and archaeologists. And we noticed something that we found peculiar as an archaeologist and an anthropologist. When these books, and I won't mention any names because everyone knows what they are, but many of these books that convey the broad sweep of human history leave out most of the research that has actually been done in the last 50 or 60 years, which is odd, something we found odd, and which in the context of those debates about social inequality and the roots of social inequality is also a political, I mean, it does also have political connotations, which are not trivial in our opinion. So the motivation to try and do this was partly just to try and introduce readers to some part of the incredibly rich,
yes, absolutely,
evidence which is out there now. It's like my favorite comparison these days. You know, you've probably seen those incredible images from what's it called, the James Webb Telescope, yeah. Like the new cosmos and our place in it. And it's totally bewildering, and all your stable points of reference have suddenly vanished. And I think what's happened to our picture of human history in, say, the last 30 or 40 years is kind of equivalent to that. We've lost a lot of what we thought were the solid points of reference and the kind of common sense truths about the long-term history of our species. And we wanted to convey something of that.
I love that analogy, actually. And sometimes I think the last few decades in archaeology and archaeological science, it's almost like a mirror of astronomy, where astronomy has so many different spectra of light to explore the universe, and we have suddenly received all these different sort of perspectives. It's almost like having new telescopes to look at the past, isn't it?
Right. So the tiny pamphlet that we originally envisaged would have made two points. One was about hunter-gatherers. The term hunter-gatherer is supposed to convey what human beings were like for something like, 99% of our existence on this planet. But I think probably most people's mental image when you say hunter-gatherer is probably of a very rudimentary kind of life of little bands of egalitarian people wandering in some nomadic fashion through the landscape, which really is about as far as you can get from the picture we have these days of what people were really doing before the coming of agriculture. So we wanted to get some of that across. And the other thing was about cities. And we wanted to show that actually these days, there's no particular reason to think that when human beings, for the first time, begin aggregating in really large settlements, this is supposed to mean the origins of government and the origins of the state. Whereas actually the picture that we have now from many different continents, including this region and Pakistan to the north, complicates that picture in all kinds of interesting ways that really make you question some of these basic assumptions about what it means to be 8 billion people on the planet and live in large-scale societies. Mm. Does it really imply a particular form of political structure, for example?
Yes.
So that was going to be it, and then it grew and grew and
it's
became
very large.
This 700-page thing.
Magnum opus.
Yeah.
Did you both of you sort of maybe have any inkling of the impact that this book would have and how big it was going to be? I know you envisaged it as something much smaller, perhaps with an academic audience, or did you think from the beginning that this might be something that was going to be very much more widely accessible and widely received?
I think we knew. I mean, David, my co-author, was a slightly mischievous sort of person, and I think he knew that this was going to ruffle feathers, sort of mess things up a little bit, not with any sort of bad intention, but just a kind of
disrupting.
Yeah, just pose some questions about very sort of taken for granted assumptions about social inequality. Mm. And we started with very conventional sort of academic papers, but the minute we published a more popular article, the response was very strong. Mm-hmm. Some of it was very critical, but it was clear that there was a huge amount of interest. And he'd been round the block with books that he'd written before, like Bullshit Jobs and his book on debt, The Last 5,000 Years. And what he'd understood, which I think, and actually this is one of, to me, the most important things about, the last year and the reception of the book, is that it is a big 700-page book with a 65-page bibliography and lots of footnotes. But yeah, I mean, the only book that was selling more copies in America was Will Smith's autobiography.
Yeah, people and, have an appetite for really solid, serious stuff.
They do, and I think David had noticed this, that actually you don't, you know, you're often told as an academic, if you want to write for a broader audience, you must dumb down, you know, basically dumb down your writing and sort of talk to people as if they're fools. And I think that's nonsense. And I'm very happy that, you know, I think we've hopefully gone some way to showing that that's not true, actually.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the strength of this book is that it manages to combine scholarly content, really quite detailed explorations of particular ethnographic and archaeological case studies, but it's also somehow quite light at the same time and a little bit playful. There's some nice humour in there. You know, you poke fun at ideas and at yourselves a little bit in some ways. And I like, you know, for example, at the beginning of the book, you talk about the title. And, you know, was this title too much? The Dawn of Everything. But, you know, it's a big bold book. And as I said, the design of the cover, it packs a punch. I noticed David is wearing a nice matching T-shirt today, which goes very well. Nice complimentary look. But, you know, I was thinking when I was sort of preparing for this talk that the cover of the book itself, it's the colours of dawn, you know. It embodies this idea of what I think makes the book very powerful, which is not just that it has breadth and depth, but it's not attempting to be a grand theory of everything, as in giving all the answers. It's much more about a beginning, a throwing light on very big questions that are of wide interest. And, you know, I think no matter what your interest is, as a reader, you come to this book and you find something in there that is surprising, that will make you sort of rethink some of your own assumptions and perhaps sort of biases. And so in that way, it's kind of, it's a mirror, but it's also a window into giving you a new path to your own thoughts. And, you know, I'm a prehistorian as well as David. So this session is going to focus a little bit on the very old aspects of the archaeology in this book. So I kind of wanted to really hear you talk about the wonderful explorations of some of the oldest archaeology that you feature in this book. So this is what we call Paleolithic, so it's the Stone Age, older Stone Age archaeology, hunting and gathering peoples, and your chapter title where you discuss this is Unfreezing the Ice Age, so I'd love to hear you talk about that
chapter. I actually stole that title off a Twitter follower. He wrote, Unfreezing the Ice Age. Now, this is one of the things social media is good for. You can pinch things off people who are more creative than you.
What do you think is something that was most powerful in that chapter that sort of embodies what you both felt was an important thing for people to understand about the new evidence for how people were living during this period of the Ice Age 30,000 odd years ago?
Yeah, well, going back to what you said before about the scope of the book, I've been very struck. Actually, the day we came into Jaipur, my wife and I were in the car, and we drove past a political march, a protest, and they were carrying brooms, and I gather the broom, the brush has become a political symbol. And I think it struck me as a very powerful symbol in terms of sweeping away corruption and brushing away outdated thinking about politics. And actually, that's kind of what this book, I mean, that's how we envisaged it, was like a sort of brush clearing exercise to sort of just try and brush away the cobwebs of these incredibly outdated notions, which are actually the foundational paradigms of Western politics coming, you know, out of the 17th and 18th century and out of the Age of Enlightenment, which are still, presented as common sense political theory. So it was really a book about asking better questions, as you say, just the beginning of something, and then we plan to go on and write more, having figured out what the questions might be, actually try to answer some more of them. So starting with the very earliest, I mean, with the evolution of our species, you know, people have lots of fun, have always had lots of fun trying to imagine what the original human society was like. I think the 1980s, for some reason, produced some of the most vivid sort of images of this. You had the killer ape, as in Stanley Kubrick, Space Odyssey, you had the killer ape theory. You had the aquatic ape theory. Do you remember that?
Yes, it's still there.
It's still
living.
There. It's supposed to account for why we have, you know, this nice sort of aquiline, hairy bodies is because we came out of the water.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. You had the stoned ape, one of the funniest ones, where human consciousness actually evolves from magic mushrooms and, you know, this sort of thing. And I think it's very natural for people to speculate like that. But actually, as I hope you'll agree with me, I think one of the things we've learned since the 1980s is that it's kind of a fool's errand to try and pinpoint an original form of human society or a moment when Homo sapiens, you know, suddenly, like the Kubrick thing, bah, you know, here we are, human beings have appeared. It didn't really happen that way, right? We have fossil evidence now from all over the African continent showing that you have multiple hominin species coexisting, interbreeding. The Sahara becomes like a sort of pump with human populations, sometimes isolated from each other for long enough to develop really, really major physical differences. You know, somebody, as Tom Higham commented, that if we could project ourselves back 200,000 years and look around at what passes for our closest relatives, it would look more like a sort of Tolkien landscape of hobbits, elves, and giants and dwarfs,
yes,
or something.
Lots of diversity.
Right. So the kind of physical differences that we find fundamental today, pigmentation, you know, things that people have been killed over, things that we fought wars over, actually incredibly trivial by comparison to the kind of physical differences that would have existed among our early ancestors. And, you know, if there's that much diversity on the physical plane, just imagine what's going on culturally.
Yes.
With language, with child-rearing practices, with gender. So, you know, I think that's kind of our starting point, is that although it's fun to have theories, we have to kind of do away with this idea of finding the original kernel of the human being and accept that actually we are the product of a kind of, we're a composite, we're a product of this mosaic of different populations.
Yeah, I really liked how, you know, as well as this discussion about the very early sort of context of human origins, what I really enjoyed was the way that you present some of the more recent sort of past decade or so research on how there really is quite strong evidence for particular, quite dynamic social structures and social formations. For example, the mammoth structures made of mammoth bones that are found in Eastern Europe and Russia, dating roughly 30,000 years ago. And you know what they tell us. Maybe you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was basically an experiment that we tried, which sounds like a very common sense thing to do. We say, well, let's try, if we're talking about reconstructing the earliest forms of human societies, let's start with the earliest direct evidence for what that was. And actually, the point in time at which you have enough archaeological evidence to actually reconstruct something of what humans are up to, you know, how they bury their dead, how they move around the landscape, is actually, I think, and again, it'd be interesting to know your opinion about this, it comes pretty late, just because of problems of archaeological survival. You know, it comes pretty late in the human story. And it's very much influenced by huge biases in our evidence. You know, there's been a huge bias towards Europe and Eurasia. and we're still learning a great deal about sub-Saharan Africa, about this part of the world, and I think the whole picture is going to radically change over the next few decades. But for the time being, I think it is around the time of the last ice age, the last glacial maximum, about 25, 30,000 years ago, on the continent of Europe, that we have enough evidence to say, well, what was going on socially? And what we see is a million miles away from that, you know, sort of standard image of hunter-gatherers as these, you know, rather simple, unstructured, nomadic societies. For example, we have these huge buildings, which are really monumental by the standards of the day, made from the tusks and the bones of woolly mammoth, great sort of meeting houses. And we have these extraordinary burials. Now, this is kind of fascinating because these are burials of people which are found over a very wide area, actually from Russia all the way down to Iberia. And if you saw these burials in any other period of human history, you would probably think this was a royal tomb or the burial of a chief or a prince or a princess. Actually, archaeologists love inventing names. You know, we're dealing with human societies before the invention of writing. So archaeologists have the great liberty of making up names. So they will call this the, what's the one in Liguria? We have Il Principe, which is a burial about 20,000 years old of an individual with the most extraordinary personal ornamentation and batons and weaponry and things that look like regalia in what is supposed to be an egalitarian hunter-gatherer. You know, we're tens of thousands of years before the origins of agriculture. So what's going on there? It's very hard to say. But at the very least, it suggests that there is something fundamentally wrong about our standard picture of social evolution. Another extraordinary thing about these burials is the actual demographic profiles. Quite a number of them are adolescents. And the science is very good these days, so we can actually see on the skeletal remains that an extraordinary number of the individuals who were given these very careful, elaborate burials had congenital conditions, which mean that today, if they were here walking around among us, they would probably be considered to have disabilities. So it's actually some of the most vulnerable individuals who seem to have been singled out for this kind of special treatment. So, you know, immediately does away with this rather, you know, simplistic idea that all early human life was nasty, brutish, and short, and, you know, rather barbaric. Clearly, there's something much more sophisticated going on here. Yeah. But what is it? You know, do we then assume that these societies were very hierarchical? What do we make of that? So in the book, we offer some hypotheses about how to understand it.
Yeah, no, I think that's the great challenge with the archaeology of this period. And, you know, my own work is on Neanderthals, which is, goes even further back in time. And, you know, the, in general, we don't have vast amounts of evidence, but occasionally you do get sites with wonderful magical preservation. And, in, you know, in those instances, they add to this picture of the diversity of the ways of living in this deep past. And I think you can say the same for sure about Neanderthals. We should expect there to have been many ways to be a Neanderthal too. I think I would like to maybe move on a little bit more recent in time and discuss the Neolithic, because, you know, I found this period, so the Neolithic is the emergence of agriculture and farming. It happens in many different ways around the world at slightly different times. But I really loved the discussions that you have about, first of all, the emergence of agriculture itself as perhaps something more akin to play and experimentation rather than something sort of focused on, we need a food surplus, you know?
Yeah, you know, there is this idea, which is still quite popular and prominent, that there was something called the agricultural revolution, and that the origins of food production was this kind of you know, radical break in human history that gives rise to all sorts of things: private property, territoriality, warfare, populations increase, and so on and so forth. Actually, the picture that we have these days of the transition from hunting and gathering to food production, is totally different. First of all, it's an extremely gradual process, regardless of which bit of the world you're looking at. We also know now that there were at least 10 totally independent centers of plant and animal domestication, and India was one of them. So, you know, the idea that there was just one transition and then everything changed for our species looks kind of ridiculous in the light of the information that we have now. Actually, what we see are many transitions, and some of them were reversible. We have examples of human populations in the British Isles, for example, adopting domestic cereals, and then after a certain number of generations deciding, no, actually, had enough of that. We're going to go back together.
Didn't like it very much.
Yeah. I mean, actually, some of the famous Neolithic monuments, like Stonehenge in England, were built, constructed during a period when the inhabitants of the British Isles decided they'd had enough of cereal farming and went back to gathering nuts as their staple plant food. They kept the domestic animals, you know, some of them. So, you know, this idea that there is this sort of once and for all transition. There are some fabulous examples in India, for example. We don't talk about it in the book, but to the south on the Deccan Plain, you have the ash mound tradition in the Neolithic 5,000 years ago, which illustrates very nicely something that we talk about, which is the kind of fluidity of prehistoric society. These ash mounds are huge. I think the most famous one is called Kudatini. It's next to a village called Kudatini, and it's huge. I mean, it's the size of a football pitch. And these places have been investigated, and they're known to be the result of cattle herders, pastoralists, moving seasonally around the landscape. And at certain times of year, they will congregate for festivals, for feasts, and they will create an entirely different form of society to the one that they live in the rest of the year, when they are, in fact, moving around very mobile in small groups. So you actually have these societies, prehistoric societies, which are what anthropologists call dimorphic. They have two forms of religious life, two forms of political life. It's kind of interesting, because if you have your foot in one social reality part of the year, and in another social reality for the other part of the year, again, that implies quite an amount of sophistication,
yeah, and
the ability to reflect, you know.
Yeah. And something else I thought was really powerful in this chapter to do with agriculture as well is that you're quite focused on gender and the roles perhaps that women particularly had in all of these explorations and new creation of relations with plants and animals. And so, just maybe we could talk a little bit about that, about the very famous site, Çatalhöyük, in Turkey, which beautiful archaeology, absolutely incredible, and representations of women as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember giving a talk about this book in, I think it was in Denmark, and a little girl came up to the stage afterwards with her mom, and her mom said, she's very shy, but she wants to ask you a question. I said, of course. And she said, look, I read your book, and I went back to school, and I said, look, to my history teacher, why are there no women in history, your history, you know, the one you're teaching us? And, you know, I think this is true of a lot of deep history, of prehistory, is that women are kind of invisible very often. You know, you get this kind of story about the origins of farming. It's kind of a joke. People like to say, well, humans didn't domesticate the wheat. The wheat domesticated us. It's kind of fun. But it's also kind of silly, because wheat is a form of grass, and you know, we're quite sophisticated primates, and you know, one has to ask, what is then being left out? What is being obviated by that kind of idea? And I think in many cases it is women's work and women's science which is being sort of hidden in that process. And if you think about what's involved with the manipulation of plants, and you know, here we are in a big textile production region, so nobody here needs to learn this from us, but you know, the kind of practical, mathematical and geometrical knowledge that's generated by engagements with fabrics and plant fibers.
Yeah, there's all the different levels. You have the understanding of the nurturing of the plants, of growth, reproduction, and then all of those skills that come from the products as well. You know, basketry and everything that involve women. And yeah, I mean, at Çatalhöyük, what always has fascinated me is there are these very striking figurines, representations of women, and many of them, although they're not overwhelming in terms of all of the figurines, but many of them are what appear to me to be older women, and in particular women whose bodies appear to have been sort of, have had many children, in fact. They look as if they have been, their fertility is on display in their bodies as well.
Are you heading towards a hypothesis about matriarchy in the Neolithic?
I think we can at least, if we assume that some of the representations of men, because there are paintings at Çatalhöyük on the walls, little stick figures, which are male, and they're hunting big aurochs, so the ancestors of cattle, and those are assumed to be real representations of hunts, whereas there's always been this debate, what are these female figurines? Are they real people? Could they, or no, they have to be goddesses or just something else. They can't be real, powerful individuals.
I mean, what this reminds me of, which we do go into later in the book, is the civilization of Bronze Age Crete, what's sometimes called the ancient Minoan civilization, which is kind of fascinating. They did invent a writing system, so this is going back about 3,500 years into the Bronze Age. And this is a civilization which had huge palaces and a writing system called Linear A, which has never been deciphered. So a lot is speculative about it, but partially because of the volcanic eruption on the island of Thera, modern Santorini, which buried large parts of the eastern Mediterranean under a layer of volcanic ash. We have this incredibly rich art, and one of the richest bodies of images from the ancient world. And what it depicts in large measure is women. Women performing important religious rituals, women holding symbols of power, women in positions of authority. Now, how do you think this is interpreted? Well, were these to be pictures of men, I think it's pretty obvious what people would say about them, because they do say these things about the art of Egypt and Mesopotamia, Anatolia. They'd say, well, this is probably what the society was like, and you have these very powerful male figures. But because it's women, the kind of reaction you get is, well, we don't really know what's going on there.
Is it a goddess? Is it just...
It pertains to, you know, ideas about ritual or some kind of theatrical staging. But, you know, clearly, you know, can't be anything to do with politics or...
It can't be real.
Or social life.
So, impossible.
Yeah, I mean, as my co-author used to joke, he said, well, it's true. There is no historical or ethnographic parallel for a large-scale, sophisticated, literate society that was governed largely by women. However, there is also no parallel for a sophisticated, literate, large-scale society governed by men, where most of the art and the imagery depicts women in positions of power. So what are we to make of this? And one of my favorite archaeological observations about it, in a book by a colleague of mine who I won't name, he says, well, the Minoan civilization, it's a bit impenetrable, which I think is the ultimate gendered observation.
Well, we're sort of coming towards the end, and I think I would, you know, I would like to just talk a little bit about your work and the other David's contribution to this as well, and just the process of dual authoring a book, because it's not that common. I'd really like to hear just a little bit about how you worked as a team, what your dynamic was, maybe how you potentially inspired each other or maybe annoyed each other. And was there anything that maybe you wanted to include as well in the book that didn't get in there, something?
Well, I mean, it is very much, the book is very much the product of a friendship. And I think it's very important to emphasize that because as I've said before, I think there is a lot about our work and what goes on in academic life and in universities these days. Like most walks of life and work, actually makes it very difficult to form friendships and sustain friendships. Everything is very corporatized, everything is very managerial. So I think it's important to emphasize that it was the product of a friendship, and we're very, and we both work very hard. You know, there's a lot of research in there.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, David in particular was very anti-work. I mean, he was very anti the concept of work feeling like work. He said, well, it shouldn't feel that way. You know, it should feel like fun. It should feel like play. And that's the spirit in which we did it, was always on the understanding that if it becomes another of these sort of things where you sort of get up in the morning, oh, God, you know, we've got to finish that chat, we just stop. You know, just stop doing it. If it gets boring, just stop doing it. If it gets annoying, becomes another albatross. And that's probably why it took 10 years to write.
10 enjoyable years.
Because we did it when we felt like it. And I'm told by readers that, you know, something of that comes across, which is nice.
And you have had just the most incredible response to this book, you know, from many communities, academics, but also, you know, everyday people who just, you know, really delve into the scholarship here and find something there. And, you know, maybe just as a final question, I'd like to ask, have there been any responses or sort of dialogues that you've had since it was published that maybe have particularly resonated with you, and that maybe have slightly changed how you think as well?
Yeah, lots. And they don't always come from the direction you might think. And one of the most unexpected things for me has been the way that the book crosses lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, between different age groups, different walks of life, different educational backgrounds. So I'm just thinking most recently, I was lucky enough to meet a musician, an artist, who came to London to perform a song in the Royal Festival Hall at a protest evening about human rights in Iran, the Women, Life and Freedom Movement. And she performed a song called The Dawn of Everything, which was inspired by a book.
Wonderful.
And I thought, well, you know, if people are writing songs about an archaeology book, then, you know, something's happened here which I don't fully understand.
Something's a bit special.
I think there is something a bit special, which, and this isn't false modesty, but I do think this is really about my late co-author, who was an exceptional person and had an extraordinary way of being able to take some of these rather obscure topics and bodies of information and think about them and write about them in a way that made them personal to people and made them feel close to their own experience and their own lives. So that sort of thing is kind of overwhelming to me and a bit hard to digest. It'll take a while, I think, to process the reactions to the book.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.